Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, as the United States swears in its 44th president, we talk with a legal expert about what a Barack Obama administration may mean for U.S. Catholics and institutions. And 100 years working towards Christian unity. We hear how the initiative got started. As Democrat Barack Obama is sworn in as the United States' 44th president, the Vatican and Catholics the world over are wondering how things will change in Washington after 8 years under Republican President George Bush. We must remember that U.S. Catholic bishops launched a pre-election information campaign to help Catholic voters familiarize themselves with the Church's stance on the moral issues at stake. While they did not come out in favor of one candidate or another, they discouraged Catholics from voting for a candidate who supported abortion, euthanasia, or embryonic stem cell research. As we saw later, many Catholics turned out to vote for Barack Obama, despite his positions on some issues that run counter to Catholic teaching. Well, to gauge just what American Catholics expect or might demand from the new U.S. president, I sat down with Richard Garnett, a professor at Notre Dame School of Law in Indiana, who spent many years with the U.S. Supreme Court. I wanted to know what legislation he expects the new president to push through Congress that is likely to affect Catholics and others, too. But first, I asked Professor Garnett why he thinks so many American Catholics voted for Senator Obama, and to what extent do U.S. Catholics listen to the Church and its bishops in matters of morals and politics.
Catholics voted for Senator Obama in the same percentage as the population as a whole, so there's no change. There is research that suggests that among Catholics who are weekly Mass goers, sort of the more serious Catholics, that they voted less for Senator Obama, that John McCain won among those voters. So it could be that among Catholics who are more regular Mass goers, who maybe heard this kind of message from the bishops more clearly, that they did take it more to heart. Nonetheless, it does seem clear that American Catholics as a whole, like Americans as a whole, were thinking more about economic questions or just perhaps their frustration with the war in Iraq, and they seemed willing to put on the back burner questions of abortion or embryonic stem cell research and so on. And Senator Obama fairly deftly was able to talk in ways that resonated with a lot of religious believers in the United States, I think. He was more comfortable talking about his own faith than probably John McCain was. And he tended not to play up his abortion views while on the stump. So, for instance, I think there were a lot of American Catholics who really didn't know, notwithstanding what the bishops did, who didn't understand what Senator Obama's record was on abortion-related questions. So now that he's going to be the president, obviously the question for a lot of Catholics, and I think for the bishops as well, is going to be, well, how aggressive will he be in pursuing his abortion rights agenda? Because certainly many of his supporters are going to be expecting him to be fairly aggressive in expanding abortion rights, expanding funding for abortion. He's already said he's going to add more money for embryo destructive research. There'll be pressure on him to change some policies with respect to gay rights and so on. So I think the bishops are going to – we're going to see more from them on these kinds of questions because they're likely to be on the front burner of politics in the years to come.
What has Mr. Obama actually said with regard to his intentions towards liberalizing abortion laws?
Well, he said on the campaign trail that, quote, the first thing he would do would be to sign a bill called the Freedom of Choice Act, which is a dramatic piece of legislation that would effectively undo every piece of pro-life legislation that has been passed in the last 20 years. It would expand funding for abortion both here and abroad. And perhaps most controversially, it would require hospitals, whether they're Catholic or not, to provide the so-called morning after pill, which many people believe operates as an abortion device. Now, he said that on the campaign trail to a pro-choice group. Candidates say a lot of things. Maybe he won't be able to follow through on that. Most people think he actually doesn't have the votes in Congress to get that done. So instead, what he's going to do, and I think he's been very clear on this, is he's going to use executive orders, where you don't need to use Congress, you can just do this on your own, to increase funding for embryonic stem cell research. He will expand funding for abortion for poor women, again, both in the United States and in other countries through foreign aid programs. And things that are a little bit below the radar, there'll be increased funding for abortions on military bases, for example. Money that the current administration was giving to crisis pregnancy centers will probably be redirected to Planned Parenthood and these kinds of things. So we probably won't see anything as dramatic as this Freedom of Choice Act I mentioned. But I think below the radar, there'll be a very consistent effort to sort of put the administration on the pro-abortion rights side of things, whereas for the past 8 years, below the radar, the administration was usually on the pro-life side of things.
You mentioned that Catholic hospitals and other institutions would have a problem with this if they felt that they were being forced to impose or to allow patients to take the morning after pill,
right,
for example. What will this mean for Catholic institutions?
This is a very potentially dramatic moment, actually. So in the United States, Catholic hospitals provide care for many low-income people, many of whom, most of whom probably are not Catholic. In a lot of our larger cities and the inner cities, the real lifeline for health care for low-income people is often Catholic hospitals who are operating on shoestring budgets. If the law were to change in such a way that they were required, you know, for their license, say, to provide the morning after pill, or even to provide abortions, to perform abortions, or even to refer patients to places where they could get abortions, all these kinds of things at the hospitals. I mean, they want to provide health care and they want to serve the poor, but they don't want to be put in a position of having to participate in something that the church teaches is immoral. If the law were to say you've got to do this as a condition of being a hospital, I suspect the bishops would try to close some of these hospitals or have to sell them off. And the problem is there isn't really a market for these hospitals. You might not be able to sell them. So the danger here is that if the administration is too aggressive on the abortion rights front, they could have the sort of unintended consequence of reducing health care for poor people in our inner cities. So I suspect, actually, they'll probably back off precisely because of that reason.
But also this raises another issue. Does the U.S. government or U.S. courts, do they have the right to impose these sort of restrictions on faith, on people of faith who believe that it's morally wrong to adopt these measures?
Well, the complicated thing under American law is once you're in business, once you're operating in commerce, the federal government can regulate you. That's a quick and dirty way of saying it, but that's basically the rules. So the stance of the law would be, we understand that you're a Catholic institution, but you're out here providing a service in commerce. You're dealing with the government because they're getting public money. And so if you're going to play that role, if you're going to receive federal funds, then you're going to have to accept the fact that some regulations are going to come with it. Now, up until now, the government, particularly the current administration and the Republicans in Congress, have been willing to negotiate and to compromise with religious hospitals so that they don't have to give up their character, their religious character. The question is whether the next administration will have that same view, because at least some abortion rights groups think are very troubled by the fact that Catholic hospitals don't provide abortions. As they see it, the fact that Catholic hospitals won't do abortions limits access to abortion for poor women. So the way they would frame it is, look, the government has a responsibility to increase access. And after all, a lot of these women who are coming to these hospitals, they're not Catholic. So why should they be denied access just because the hospital's Catholic? What that position doesn't appreciate, in my view, is that these hospitals have a right to be who they are, right? To form themselves in a way that's consistent with the very faith that motivates them to provide health care in the first place.
Another topic which is similar in nature would be the federal funding for faith-based education, for faith-based schools, which has also been an issue that's just been in the public eye for years and years and years. Mm. But I know that you see advantages to keeping the church and state separate in faith-based education, and that federal funding that does come with these restrictions. Is that good or bad, though?
Well, it's a tricky situation. So currently in the United States, we have a system where the government runs the public schools, and then various private groups, including the church, run private schools. The government does provide some financial assistance to private and religious schools, usually in the form of things like school lunches or bus transportation, or they'll loan books and computers. But a lot of Catholics believe that because Catholic schools are so important, especially in inner cities, that they should be getting more financial support from the government, not just the federal government, but state and local governments as well. So we've seen some programs in a few places like Cleveland, Ohio, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a few other places where the government is starting these programs of scholarships for poor kids, where kids who don't have much money are given basically a voucher from the government that they can go and take to a Catholic school. I think these programs are excellent. Again, as I said, Catholic schools are providing this wonderful service for poor kids. They're not making any money doing it. It's frankly a bargain for the government to have these kids go to Catholic schools instead of the government's own schools, which are very expensive. The tricky thing comes when the government says, all right, since we're giving you money, we're going to regulate you more. One of the things that in America is very special and I think very good that distinguishes our schools from the Catholic schools in Europe is that our Catholic schools really do have a lot of independence. They can choose their own curriculum, by and large. They can hire and fire who they want to. They can pick teachers who are Catholic, who have good values, who are good examples for the kids. In Europe, there's a lot more regulation of what Catholic schools do. They're made to look more like government schools. So I think if you really care about Catholic education, as I do, you want to make sure that Catholic schools can stay independent. So my position is that the government should fund Catholic schools because they are providing this public service, they are providing a good education, but they should let them stay independent in terms of hiring and firing and curriculum and admissions and those sorts of things. And that's the real fine balance. Legislators quite understandably want to make sure that if they're giving money to schools that there's some accountability, but the danger is that that accountability will cross the line into interference with their Catholic character. So far in the states, we've actually done a pretty good job of striking this balance. So Catholic schools have been able to get some funds but still remain authentically Catholic. And I think we have to just be vigilant and make sure that continues.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that with an Obama administration, we would be seeing perhaps a change for government funding of Catholic schools or religious schools?
It's tricky. Senator Obama enjoyed the support, as Democrats usually do in America, of our unions of teachers, our public school teachers unions, who are very powerful politically. And they are extremely opposed, more opposed than they are to almost anything, to public funds going to Catholic schools. And in my view, they're quite wrong in this view, but that's their view. So Senator Obama, on the one hand, you could say this is an interest group that supported him very strongly, and they wouldn't want him to give any more money to parochial schools. On the other hand, you could say he's more so than many Democrats has actually expressed some interest in education reform and thinking creatively and pushing back against the teachers' unions a little bit. So the political fight, I think, will be to what extent is Senator Obama, President-elect Obama, willing to stand up to teachers' unions and to listen to people, many of whom are African-Americans living in the inner city who are low income, many of whom voted for Senator Obama, but who want these vouchers because they see that the public schools in their neighborhood are not doing a good job. The government schools are not doing a good job of educating their kids. They're often unsafe. They're low performing. And they look down the street and they see this little parish school where there's discipline, where the kids are learning, where they're graduating. And it doesn't cost that much money, but it costs more than they happen to have. So if the government were to help out a little bit, there'd be a lot more opportunity for their kids. The big test is going to be there's actually a program that's up and running in Washington, D.C., which gives federal money to children, low-income children attending Catholic schools in D.C. The teachers union doesn't like this program. Many Democrats in Congress don't like it, but it seems to be working, and it has the strong support of the African-American mayor of Washington, D.C. So if Senator Obama lets that program continue, that might be a suggestion that he's open to dialogue on this question. If he works to shut it down, that'll be a bad sign.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'd like to change tactics a little bit. In a system that Pope Benedict himself has described as the American model of healthy secularism, a separation of church and state that appears to work, what role does religion play in the U.S. today? And do you expect to see any changes with this new administration?
So on the second question first, I don't think so. I mean, it's true that there's the Republican Party has a great deal of support from evangelical Christians who are very open about their faith and about the connections between their faith and politics. Many in the Democratic Party are seen as more secularist or anti-religious. But in fact, many of those who supported Senator Obama are also religious believers. So I think Senator Obama is not going to be somebody who's sort of eager to banish religion from the public square. Obviously, he has different policy views than George Bush had. But I think what was true before is going to continue to be true, which is that American politics and American life have a more religious flavor than many European countries. In America, the separation of church and state is interesting. That term is so often misunderstood because some people think mistakenly that separating church and state means that faith has nothing to do with politics, but that's not what it was supposed to mean. In America, it's always been the case that religious believers have been inspired by their faith to go out and get involved in politics, whether it was the Revolution, whether it was slavery, whether it was civil rights, whether it's abortion. Faith has always animated politics. That has nothing to do with separation of church and state in our country. In some European countries, I think it does. For us, the separation of church and state has meant primarily that the government doesn't set up an official church. It doesn't directly fund religion with money. It can support indirectly, but doesn't directly support the churches with money. And more importantly, and this is what's healthy about our secularism, I think, is that the government understands that religious institutions have the right to self-government. Right? They get to run themselves. They get to decide who they want to be. So if you think of the most kind of obvious example, there have been times in history when the government has assumed that it was its job to pick the bishops, right? And we've had a lot of fights throughout the history of the Catholic Church on this question. Even in China today, the government purports to be able to select bishops. In America, what the separation of church and state means is that the church gets to govern itself. The church gets to be the church. It doesn't mean that religious people can't talk about politics, can't be involved in politics. It doesn't mean the bishops shouldn't try to tell people what the issues are. But it does mean that religious authority and political authority are separate. And the way it's worked for us has been a way that really protects religion from the state, which always has an incentive to try to meddle with it, you know. So that's what's healthy about it. Now, sometimes in America, religious believers hear the word secularism, and they think that means anti-religion. And for some people it does, and it shouldn't. That's not an attractive point of view, in my opinion. Secularism, if it's properly understood, it only needs to mean that it's non-religious. So our political establishment, our political authority is non-religious. Doesn't mean the people are non-religious. It just means that the authority itself comes from the people who are all faiths and none. And religion is welcome in the public square. It's welcome in political debates. But political authority and religious authority are distinguished in a way that, in the long run, I think protects religious liberty.
You know, I can't help but wonder sometimes, what would America be like if there was no religion, or if America decided to adopt some form of laïcité like you see in France?
It can never happen. I mean, America's revolution, people overlook this sometimes, was never a war against God. It was never a war on tradition across the board. It was not anti-religion. The French Revolution, I think it's fair to say, was very different. In America, the founding fathers, the revolutionary generation, they really thought of themselves as trying to claim their rights as Englishmen. The revolution only happened, for most of our framers, after they were sort of rebuffed by the king in their efforts to stand on their rights as Englishmen. So when you look at the American Constitution, it borrows heavily from the English Constitution, right? Our understanding of what our rights were came in large measure from what we understood the rights of Englishmen to be and from our colonial experience. So if the French Revolution was much more of a kind of throwing off of all tradition, the American Revolution wasn't. It was much more modest and incremental. And one of the things about our revolution that's so important is that it was, in very large respect, motivated by a religious belief. We had in America, the Great Awakening in the early to mid-18th century, which was a real sort of powerful evangelization movement where all kinds of people who might have been unchurched or just sort of, lackadaisical in their religion sort of got fired up with an early form of evangelical Christianity. That movement was one of the real players in pushing our revolution and making it happen. So our revolution in many ways was a religiously tinged revolution. Now, when we started our new governments, when we formed our constitution, it was set up to be secular, but not in the sense of being anti-God, just in the sense that it acknowledged that religion was independent of the government. So our constitution protected religious liberty, and it was never aggressively anti-religion, never anti-religion at all, but it simply thought that political authority and religious authority would be separate. So I think it's actually impossible to think of American history without religion. For better or worse, America's always had a sense of mission. The early Americans really thought that there was something providential about having arrived in America, that America presented an opportunity for freedom, which for them was inseparable from religious freedom. And today, when you look around the world, it seems to me that America's a place where religion in all kinds of forms, you know, some traditional, some kind of creative or even wacky, is thriving, you know. And I just think it's impossible to imagine America without that. And I don't see it changing. I mean, it's true that there are some segments of our population, you know, some elites, which are becoming less religious and perhaps more European. But the basic swath of the American people is still quite observant in a way that I think confounds a lot of our friends across the water. But I think that's a part of who we are. I don't see it changing soon.
Richard Garnett is a professor at Notre Dame's School of Law in Indiana. For almost a century, in the month of January, a growing number of Christians from denominations across the board have set aside a week of prayer for Christian unity, an initiative that began with a group of Episcopalian Catholic religious in the United States. They chose January 18th to the 25th, the week in which we celebrate feast days of the saints Peter and Paul, the apostles revered by all Christians.
From its very earliest days, the Church in Rome remembers the 18th of January as the feast of the Cathedra Petri, the feast of the chair of Peter, the day on which the Apostle Peter first led a service with the faithful in Rome. It's also the day set aside to recall Peter's confession of belief. January the 25th celebrates the feast of the conversion of St. Paul. The two feasts mark the great moments of truth for the two apostles in fully accepting God's will. At Caesarea Philippi, when Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" St. Peter replied, "You are the Messiah." And on the road to Damascus, St. Paul was blinded when Christ appeared to him and forever changed his life into one of spreading the good news.
The week of prayer for Christian unity was the brainchild of Episcopalian Reverend Lewis Watson, who, together with Sister Lorana White, in the early 1900s formed a new religious community within the Episcopalian Church in New York, following the Franciscan rule of life. Watson chose as his new religious name Father Paul James Francis. Well, after years of intense ecumenical work advocating the reunification of Christian churches, Father Paul and Mother Lurana decided to enter the Catholic Church. In 1909, their Society of the Atonement was received into the Roman Catholic Church, the first religious community to do so since the 16th century Reformation. Each year, the theme and the text for the Week of Prayer are chosen and prepared by representatives of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity and representatives of the World Council of Churches.
It began as an outreach among Anglo-Catholics because the Society of the Atonement was founded in the Episcopal Church, USA, as a Franciscan community at Graymore in Garrison, New York.
Father James Lockeran is the director of the Society of the Atonement's Graymore Ecumenical and Interreligious Institute in New York. He sums up for us how the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity has developed since its conception by the co-founder of his order in 1908.
In the end of the 19th century, in 1898, as a movement of men and women, really, in the Anglican Church who sought unity with the Roman Catholic Church, very simply, they believed that there was some process by which Anglicans and Roman Catholics could come together to reunite into one community. It was very naive in a way, but also very faith-filled. They believed that this would be a work of the Holy Spirit, and Father Paul Watson, the founder of the Friars of the Atonement, would often go to various Episcopal churches to preach this idea of reunion, as he called it, with Rome. And his message was not very well received, and so he began to develop a magazine called The Lamp Magazine, first published in 1903, while still an Anglican, and he used that as a vehicle to promote what he called at that time Christian unity or reunionism. In the process, he befriended an Anglican priest named Spencer Jones in England, who was also in the Anglo-Catholic movement, and wanted to set aside a day a year to pray for the unity of the church. And so Father Paul Watson responded, wouldn't it be better to use the traditional octave, 8 days of prayer? And so he thought perhaps January 18th to 25th would be good, because on our older calendar, January 18th was the Feast of the Chair of Peter, and the 25th is still the Feast of the Conversion of Paul. And so Spencer Jones agreed, and Father Paul, through his Lamp magazine, began to promote the idea around 1907, and in 1908 they actually celebrated in January the first Church Unity Octave, as it was called then, at Graymore.
By 1909, the idea had become a tradition, one picked up by churches across Europe. It gained impetus, though, through one of the most famous events in Vatican history.
It was in October of 1909, after the second week of prayer for Christian unity, which was, I should say, called the Church Unity Octave, that Father Paul and the foundress, Mother Lorena, and the other friars and sisters of the Atonement became Roman Catholics. They were corporately welcomed into the Catholic Church by Pope Pius X and put under the care of the Archdiocese of New York at the time. Over the years, as the friars grew in the Catholic Church, the commitment to pray for the unity of the Church continued. However, since this was before the Second Vatican Council, the Church Unity Octave focused on praying for the return of other Christians to the fullness of communion with the Catholic Church. And so it became, in a sense, a prayer by Catholics for the other Christians to come into full communion with the Catholic Church. After the Second Vatican Council, things began to change, of course, with Lumen Gentium and then, of course, the Decree on Ecumenism, so that we could begin to pray together with other Christians that the unity of the Church would come about as Christ wills it, which, of course, was the founding principle of Christian unity prayer in Europe at the time as well. So by Father Paul Couturier and others who started that movement in the 1920s to pray for the unity of the Church ecumenically rather than in a sort of one-directional type of thing.
And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.